From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The Russian decision to withdraw partially from Syria was taken jointly by a common decision taken both by President Putin and President Assad. So it wasn't a surprise for us.
That was Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations, Bashar al-Jafari, who's leading the negotiating team for the government at peace talks in Geneva, speaking at a press conference in Geneva Wednesday. He had been asked if Damascus was surprised by Russia's announcement Monday of a partial withdrawal of forces from Syria.
It was a coordinated, joint political decision taken both by Moscow and Damascus jointly. Our friends and allies, the Russians, came to Syria by a joint decision, and the day they will leave or withdraw or redeploy their forces, partially or totally, it will be done again and again and again through a joint Syrian-Russian coordination action.
Ambassador Jaafari also addressed reports that some Kurds announced plans to establish a federal region inside Syria.
The basic references for the indirect talks, Syrian-Syrian indirect talks, prohibits raising such scenarios. What we are talking about here is how to keep the unity of Syria, how to respect the unity of Syria, the independence of Syria, the territorial integrity of Syria, and the unity of Syria, land and people. So I will not comment on unilateral statements coming from here and there. The Syrian Kurds are an important component of the Syrian people. We are proud of them. They are proud of us. We have established our state together for centuries. So betting on creating any kind of divisions among the Syrians will be a total failure.
Russian Air Force Commander Viktor Bondarev said Russia will complete the withdrawal of most of its military contingent in the country within 2 or 3 days. The withdrawal began Tuesday, one day after Russia's President Vladimir Putin ordered the partial pullout. Moscow said it would retain its naval base at Tartus and its air base at Latakia and may keep its S-400 surface-to-air missile systems inside Syria. For a look at what this all means, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer at Moscow State University on international affairs, by Skype shortly after the announcement. What's going on? Russia pulling out of Syria? Is this like a mission accomplished moment?
Yeah, I unfortunately think it will probably end that way. Whether you want to count that as George W. Bush on the aircraft carrier, or whether you want to count that as Obama, Cameron, and Holland standing in front of a courthouse where people were hung by jihadis in Benghazi and Libya. Mm. I have the unfortunate feeling that this will end in a backlash that will have Putin looking at a mission accomplished moment. Mm. So the big question is why. I mean, I will admit I did not see this coming. I can't think of anyone who says honestly that they did.
Nope.
If you know someone, please let me know. Is this shocked and floored all of us, and for all intents, all indications are that it completely shocked and floored the West, particularly the United States as well. The U.S. and U.K. The governments were scrambling, making no comment for hours until they could, find out what was actually going on. So first, let's talk about the reality of the withdrawal, and it is a partial withdrawal, maybe a most withdrawal, but it is certainly not a 100% withdrawal.
Yeah, one thing that was part of the announcement, by the way, was the fact that and Russia will be maintaining its permanent naval base at Tartus and its permanent air base at Latakia.
Yes, Khmeimim and Latakia. Takia and the TARDIS naval base. The S-400 air defense systems will remain in Syria under Russian control. Russia has announced that they are keeping about 800 military personnel. This is a scaling down from somewhere probably just over 5,000. So this is a very significant. This is a more than 80% reduction in troops. 800 is probably just enough to provide a bare minimum of protection for the bases. Man the cessation of hostility monitoring program via drones, as they have announced, and to provide a skeleton crew for a bare minimum of airstrikes, but certainly nothing of the frequency or intensity of what we have seen over the last 6 months. We've already seen a number of Russian aircraft return home here in Russia, including already Su-34 fighter bombers, strike aircraft, ground air strike aircraft that were, you know, put to very good use in Syria up till now.
Right.
So the question everyone's asking is why? Why did this happen? And we've got answers across a whole range of spectrum. A lot of critics are, of course, jumping on a weak Putin or a weak Russian economy, which is complete nonsense. This military operation is extremely cheap. It cost in the single millions, $2 to $3 million dollars a day, which, you know, is Trump change, and the Russian government is sitting on almost no national debt,
right,
and only a very slight budget deficit running right now. So because of the oil price exchange in dollars turning into rubles, the Russian government is actually flush with rubles. And a lot of people don't understand this, but the Russian government is not experiencing major economic problems, however much the West might wish it so. It is not also not Russia throwing Assad under the bus. And this is one of the big problems, that it will be interpreted as such by the anti-Syrian forces, and they might act on that assumption. We've already seen this out of foreign policy speculating on this. It should not be interpreted as that way. Russia is not clearing the way for Assad to be removed. Russia's position remains that elections will be held. The Syrian current Syrian president has the right to participate, and they will not be surprised if he wins, because of the majority of the Syrian people still supporting his government.
Yeah, you can you can tell that by the resistance to allowing him to participate. That's like the main issue on the other side.
Yes, I mean that's this. They know very well that they don't have a figure to. First of all, numbers wise, you know, they're only looking at somewhere between 30% and 40% of the population, I think, max. And they have no unity figure, no major political figure that can unify the various jihadis, the smattering of say, moderate secular unicorns out there, and so on. So in any open, fair elections, the honest truth is that Assad would win again. That's the reason they don't want him to be able to participate. So why did he do this? I'll quickly, very briefly, give my rundown. It's never always, these things are never decided on one reason, but I think there's four reasons that go together. So the first reason is this is a sincere diplomatic goodwill gesture, if, in my opinion, naive, ill-conceived, and ill-fated. Directed at the West, in particular the United States, but also, you know, Turkey and their GCC allies, saying we are serious about a political settlement. We are willing to make these first steps towards a de-escalation, and now basically shoving the onus onto the United States.
Right, because even if it's not sincerely, quote unquote, a bona fide good faith gesture. Since it looks exactly like one, it has to be taken as one and treated that way politically.
Yes, yes. It'd be very difficult for the West, public relations wise, for the purposes of their narrative, to completely walk away from this.
That's right.
Can they get Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, as well as Ahrar al-Sham, al-Nusra, Jaish al-Fatah, the army of the Mujahideen, can they get these in line? I sincerely doubt it, which has been part of the problem all along. One of the reasons why I think one of the main purposes of the Russian embrace of the cessation of hostilities, as I read it, was to make what small non-extremist moderate forces, essentially Western proxies there are, to separate from their Jabhat al-Nusra al-Qaeda allies, which they are, according to the State Department, marbled with throughout the country.
Right.
They use a lot of euphemisms like standing next to, close proximity. They're allied with, right? And technically, the UN Security Council resolution calls for anyone affiliated with ISIS or al-Qaeda in any way, shape, or form to be eradicated. But since that's essentially everyone, Russia would like the opportunity, and save the West some political face to have some amount of people that aren't committed to that extremist ideology step away from the abyss that they've been allied with for the last 5 years and inject them into some transition. So the second reason I would point to is that Russia probably does want to put some measure of reality check on the Syrian government, which has been flying high for the last few months and made a lot of statements about retaking the entire country, meaning militarily, which Russia at least diplomatically disavows and probably pragmatically realizes is extremely troublesome. Certainly diplomatically it is. So I think to some extent, yes, this can be read as an acknowledgement to the Syrian government that we are only willing to go so far. There are red lines in our level of commitment, and you will have to make some negotiations and compromises, or at least the public face of them as well.
Well, and again, and you could be doing exactly the same thing merely for public relations value. In other words, you're winking and nodding at the Syrian government, but you're making the appearance in front of the people on the other side that, look, we're putting our proxy on a leash. You put yours on a leash.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I have to say that Putin, being the generally, extremely frank and honest person he is, he probably means it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I wish that it wasn't so. The third reason I would point to is that Russia has obviously changed its strategic objectives and has severely downgraded them. Just a month ago, Foreign Minister Lavrov was saying that Russia would not leave Syria until ISIS and al-Qaeda had suffered major defeats throughout the country. Obviously, that hasn't happened. Whether we're talking ISIS or Jabhat al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, or the al-Qaeda offshoot, Ahrar al-Sham, these being the three biggest forces that control the mass amount of numbers and territory of the, quote, rebels, unquote. That's about 65%, maybe closer to 70% of Syrian territory still. Right. The Syrian government still doesn't have complete control of its borders. There's still the Jarablus corridor north of Aleppo and, good portions of the Jordanian border through which arms, supplies, funding is ratlined by, Western and GCC governments to their proxies in Syria. Mm. So that's problematic. There's also major metropolitan areas, a few of them, still in jihadist hands.
Right.
Parts of Aleppo. Raqqa, certainly under ISIS. Idlib City and the entirety pretty much of Idlib is run by al-Qaeda. This often tried to present it on the maps as rebel territory, but it's al-Qaeda territory. And Palmyra. And in the last days, the Syrian Arab Army is certainly advancing on Palmyra at a rapid clip, but those other, it's not over yet. And they actually are suffering reportedly very heavy casualties in what progress they are making under what is still already decreased Russian airstrikes.
You know, on that point, though, just to interrupt for a minute, you know, Putin gave a quick laundry list of the objectives that had been met, and so did the defense minister. And if you take those things at face value, because those things are pretty much true objectively, and the fact, no, not the characterization of them, the things that they listed, like, well, you know, we cut off this supply route, we did this, we did that. With those things, and with the talks beginning, and with the other diplomatic moves that are being made, saying, hey, let's have a sit down, and with the agreement that, you know, ISIS and Al-Qaeda have no place at the table, if all the Syrians, which is the Syrian precondition, if only Syrians sit down at the table now and have a discussion and an agreement is reached, ISIS and all of them can be dealt with. The consensus opinion would include the United States and Europe that this is now the official government of Syria, and they should have free reign to reclaim the country.
If there's a lot of...
Yeah. Understood. I got it. But
the problem, again, is still separating the quote moderates unquote from the much larger jihadi forces,
for sure,
and the West acknowledging that fact,
right,
which may be even the more difficult, and then getting Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey to drop their proxies, their more jihadist proxies as well.
We did it. You do it. That's the I could see
dealing
saying
with the
that.
Kurds.
Yep.
Yeah, there's it's extremely that. Problematic.
Yep,
so true. Why has Russia changed their strategic objectives? We get to the fourth reason. And I think that Russia went in last September when and how it did with a comparatively very small expeditionary force that they have done, even U.S. military admits, amazing things with.
Right.
But to forestall a U.S.-Turkish direct intervention, the plans were obviously in motion to create a safe zone north of Aleppo on the Turkish border,
right,
and this would gradually mission creep and morph into a Libya-style regime change.
Right. Yep.
This the writing was on the wall. Russia went in to forestall this.
Yep.
They did. Ironically, I think they are now pulling out to forestall another direct intervention,
right,
because their success has been so thorough that Turkey and Saudi Arabia are making a lot of noise about going in, and the U.S. has begun to openly discuss partitioning the country.
Hmm.
So it would certainly have U.S. backing at the very least. So I think Russia is making a gesture of pulling out again to forestall a direct intervention, hoping that that satisfies them and they'll be happy with the political process. I don't think they will be. I think Putin will be forced to walk this mission accomplished moment back and recommit forces or risk losing at least major parts of Syria if the government in Damascus isn't itself threatened once again. Al-Qaeda has already announced that within 48 hours they're going to go on an offensive against the Syrian government because of this withdrawal of forces.
Mm.
Saudi Arabia says they will not base their decision whether to invade or not based on the Russian withdrawal. We know that Syrian MiG, we know for certain now, according at least to the Russian intelligence, was shot down by a U.S.-made Stinger missile three days ago, possibly indicating that that either the U.S. or its Saudi middlemen are now shoveling man pads at whoever can hold them on top of the toes, which is an extremely dangerous situation. Not so much for the Russian aircraft, which fly at a generally at a pretty high altitude, but for the Syrian aircraft, it's a threat. And for the civilian aircraft liners of the world,
right,
having man pads fall into the hands of Al Qaeda and ISIS, as they inevitably will, is potentially disastrous.
Mm.
So that's my reading. I think all of these things morph into And also, you know, Putin's constant desire to off-put the West, to never allow them to guess what he's going to do next and to always surprise them. But it surprised us. I think it surprised them. And I don't think they've fully decided how to react yet. And then the coming days will reveal at least some of it to all of us, I hope. Yeah. And I hope that I am being pessimistic. I hope that this is indeed a real Putin cunning plan, and that it is cunning and not a tragic mistake that he will be forced to walk back. I mean, there's nothing preventing Russia from going back in. They will certainly have all the infrastructure there. They are not doing a complete withdrawal. They will continue to supply the Syrian government as well as the anti-terrorist coalition they've assembled with intelligence, C4ISR, supplies, logistics, training. They now have top tanks and artillery equipment. That will not change. So it isn't a complete abandonment, but perhaps we have grown a little bit used to the idea that Russia is fully committed to seeing this to the bitter end, and they may not be. And I fear that Russia may be starting to accept the logic of partition.
Okay, and it'll be interesting to look back on this the next time we talk and see what's happened in the intervening period. Certainly more shock and awe than Bush blowing up Baghdad.
It shocked. That didn't shock anyone.
Yeah, it's true. That's right. That's right.
This shocked and awed everyone, I think. That's Once true. Again, whether this it is a risky gamble, maybe it will pay off. Maybe the West will, you know, come to its senses and recognize this for what it is. I'm extremely doubtful about that. But no one says that Putin isn't willing to, surprise everyone, make bold gestures, and risk throwing the dice.
You know, just very briefly, I got to say also, the really cute part of it is the first time that I've heard, basically, or thought about the fact that Russia is maintaining a claim to a naval base and an air base in Syria, even past the conclusion of the talks and the new government.
Yeah, I mean, well, they already had the naval base beforehand, and they certainly intend to keep the air base. And right. Like I said, you know, it may involve eating a little bit crow about a mission accomplished moment, but anytime Russia feels that red lines have been crossed, it is certainly capable, if it chooses to do so, to going to back in, although that will it will involve some difficult explaining to the Russian people, at least. Nothing that Putin's approval ratings can't handle, but certainly something that he doesn't want to have to do.
Yeah, so at the end of the day, you say to Putin 5 years from now, what happened back then in Syria? And he'll say, yeah, we gained an air base.
Yeah, and the destroyed country in the process.
Well, yeah, he's done an awful lot to try to stop the destruction. I got to agree with that. But from a geopolitical standpoint, at the end of the day, the net gain, one air base.
Yeah, Putin is certainly capable of thinking on those lines.
Has to.
But Putin is also, and I'm certain he does think, particularly about the Syrian Orthodox Christians who have been dying and are dying in large numbers. And he does feel maybe not as strong as an attachment towards protecting the people of Russia, but he certainly does feel some shred of responsibility and kindred responsibility there as well, I think.
Well, one of his talking points, just to conclude, was that among the things that have occurred since they started the bombing is finally the delivery of humanitarian aid to the Syrian people that are inside those areas. So he's already materially helped the Syrian people substantially.
Yes.
Okay, Mark, thanks a lot.
Don, thanks for having me.
The election of Barack Obama in 2008 was heralded by some as evidence that the U.S. had entered a period of post-racialism. Some even pointed to it as proof that white supremacy was dead. 8 years later, black youth are being gunned down in the street by police at the highest rate in decades. Black wealth has suffered the biggest hit in history. Massive black overrepresentation in the U.S. prison system has not abated, Public schools in black communities are either being starved of funding or handed over to private corporations. Whole black communities are being poisoned by or deprived of water. And internationally, the same phenomenon is evident. The U.S. has actually increased its military presence in Africa to record levels after being barred from the continent for three decades. Now the country is in the midst of choosing a successor to America's first black president. Some, like the Black Is Back Coalition, think it's time to get busy, as Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford reports.
Self-determination. It's a term that was once at the center of the black political discussion. How should black folks organize themselves to gain the power to shape their own destinies, and in the process build a better world and break the power of our enemies? Black people in the United States made great strides when we engaged in mass mobilization under independent black leadership with the focus on self-determination. We set the terms of discussion and put forward principled demands that were designed always to result in the accumulation of more power in the hands of our people. Sometimes that involved elections, but more often not, because elections only occur every 2 or 4 years, while the struggle for power and self-determination is constant. The Black Is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations is putting black people's self-determination back in the discussion this election season, with a national conference on the 2016 election and the struggle for self-determination. The conference takes place on Saturday, April 9th, at St. Mary's Church in Harlem, New York City. The Black Is Back Coalition will explore the possibilities and the dangers that the current electoral scene presents for the future of black people and the world. This is a conference about power, the power to kick the killer cops out of our neighborhoods and establish black community control of the police, the power to keep our people from being dispersed from the cities at the whim of rich corporations, the power to control our schools and the content and quality of our children's educations, the power that comes from economic security, the power to say yes to our friends and no to our enemies. The Black Is Back Coalition was founded in October 2009 when a broad range of black organizations decided to work together based on the principle of black self-determination and the struggle against imperialism. President Obama had just begun his first term in office. The new coalition understood that the election of a black corporate Democrat to the highest office in the land was not a step towards black self-determination. In fact, it was quite the opposite. Obama's election meant that lots of black folks would celebrate as their own incomes and wealth went further down the drain, and that many would be cheering while a black commander-in-chief slaughtered people of color all over the world. And we were right. But something else happened in the second half of Barack Obama's tenure in office, the beginnings of a mass movement. And so we arrive at the current election season with both corporate parties in a state of flux, and most importantly, an incipient black movement that is anxious to transform the political landscape through struggle outside the ballot box. Which is why the Black Is Back Coalition is holding a national conference on the 2016 election and the struggle for self-determination, Saturday, April 9th, at St. Mary's Church, 521 West 126th Street in Harlem, New York. To make arrangements, go to the Black Is Back Coalition website, because black power matters. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.